5. Saturday, sunny and 66. Sunday, sunny and 75. The numbers now, humidity at 76%, wind north at 10. We have sunshine with 61 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's all sports today on the morning show. In part one, you're going to be meeting one of the most famous boxers in the last half century. In part two, we will look back on one of the most amazing accomplishments in NBA history. Here's part one. Well, it's certainly not every day that I get to say that I am speaking with a champion boxer. In fact, in all of my years doing the morning show, this actually is a first. And not just any boxer, but a boxer who was the number one contender for the heavyweight championship of the world. I'm talking about Jerry Cooney, nicknamed Gentleman Jerry. And that is actually the title of a wonderful book about him and about his life called Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery. This book, written with John Grady, tells the story of Jerry Cooney, of all that he endured in a tough childhood, and the way in which boxing was sort of a refuge or escape for him, and how he rose to be a two-time Golden Gloves champion, and then a very successful professional fighter as well, towards the very top, the very pinnacle of professional boxing. There were also tough years for Jerry Cooney as he contended with addictions of one kind or another. And he is living now emphatically in full recovery and actually has gone on to do some really commendable things on behalf of the sport of boxing and some of his fellow retired boxers. The book at hand is published by Roman and Littlefield. Again, it's titled Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery. And Jerry Cooney, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, it's great to be on with you. And we had some great things to talk about today. And boy, I can't wait to get to there where you are, because we're going to go a couple, at least six rounds. You and me, baby. You and me.
Looking forward to it. This is great. This is great. Well, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is the fact that although there are a lot of joyous things in your book, in your story, a lot of great successes, your life and career have certainly had plenty of pain as well. In the putting together of this book with author John Grady, what was it like for you to, in a sense, relive a lot of what you have experienced in your life, including the really tough stuff? Was it hard to go through that?
You know, it's a great question, and, you know, I put it off for so long. Because, I self-sabotaged myself in the end run. And I think it was my upbringing. I got the gene, the alcohol gene, from my father. And I'm really realizing that through my family and his family and even my mother's side of the family, they have that addiction going on. And what happened when you grow up in a house like that, you don't get the tools to help cope with life. And they just passed over, and I never got to raise my hand and ask for help back in school or whatever I did in life. I just waited for the bell, and I went out and fought. Unfortunately, you know, you don't take care of yourself the best in time. Early on, I was sensational. I had two Gold Glove championships. I went to all my international boxing bouts. I won by knockout. I came to back to New York after a trip to England, and I fought the top 10. In fact, I think he was ranked third in Russia as an amateur, and I was not in shape because I was drinking beer all summer, and 6 days before the fight, I got the call, and I wanted to fight in the Garden, so I ran for 6 days, and I got in the ring, and I always liked it when the bell rang. I wanted to touch you with my power to let you know. You want to come in my house, come on. But when you come in, I hit him on the chin, and I knocked him out in the first round, thank God, because probably if I had gone to the second round, it wouldn't have been so good for me. But and then I made it to the finals of the Olympic trials, and I turned it down because low self-esteem. I wasn't confident. I wasn't didn't feel good enough from the negative, from the negativity from in my household. That's what I developed. I didn't develop, you know, courage and strength and confidence that I have now, that I passed on to the young men and that I train and work with today, so they can be all they can be.
Hmm.
And that's the biggest night of my life. I knocked out Ken Norton in 54 seconds of the first round. You think I would have said, well, I got to get a great trainer, nutritionist, a condition coach. No, that's when I started to drink.
Hmm.
That's when the light came on, fear passed over me, and I couldn't believe who I was becoming. And 13 months later, I got stopped in the 13th round, but I'm here today. I have a great life. I have a great family. They've never seen me drink and so on. So I don't want to take up all your time. I want to hear some of your questions.
Right, but this is great. I mean, and you just gave us kind of a capsule summary of just what an interesting story, in fact, this really is. Let's talk about that childhood and talk a bit about the both physical and mental abuse that you suffered at the hand of your father. When you look back at those years and your relationship with your father, how do you make sense of the way he treated you? And have you come to terms with that?
No, it's another great question. You know, obviously, he grew up in the same atmosphere, but he didn't get help for it. He didn't understand that that's wrong. You don't treat children. You have six children, and put them down, try and control them and manipulate them. You want to help them to grow. I mean, my son graduated from Lehigh University. He's an engineer today. My daughter just graduated college. My oldest son is got great jobs. You want the best for them. And somewhere along the line, in that dysfunctional head of alcoholism and addiction and abuse, you want to control them. You don't want them to be all they can be. And that was a sin. And, you know, I wished that I could have said, you know, years ago my father built a ring in the backyard when I was like 17, and I could have knocked him out, but I couldn't hit him. And sometimes I wish I would have hit him, and then I heard someone say they did, and I felt so bad about it. But I wish I could have said to him, Dad, why are you doing this for? Why? But I didn't know any better, so I sat in the back of the room, didn't tell nobody. I passed school, but I wasn't really motivated to go to college, and boxing fit right into place. I was angry. You know, I went to the gym, and boxing took care of my anger, how angry I was about what was going on. And then I was good at it. I could punch. And so that fed me and made me somebody. I remember winning the Golden Gloves at 16, and going to school, and the next morning, they announced me over the air as a middleweight champion in the New York State Golden Gloves. And in the afternoon, I get chills telling you that now, because it was a lonely place, a scary place. And, how to learn to take care of that anger and not hurt anybody. You know, when I was a kid one time, I ran into a bully. I knocked his teeth out. I thought, oh, my God, what am I doing? And, you know, I you live and learn, right?
Right. Well, and of course, and we're talking about a time when there wasn't necessarily the opportunities that there are now for a young adolescent wrestling with these kind of emotional difficulties. to talk about it. I mean, to be open. And I suspect that maybe there wasn't anybody in your life with whom you could really talk about the kind of things that you were experiencing.
You couldn't tell nobody. You weren't allowed to say it. You had to, don't tell nobody. That was the story. Don't show it. Don't tell anybody. But today, I want to just tell you something. It was a great feeling. Today, I train and work with kids that are struggling emotionally. They feel different than everybody else. And when they come to my gym, I shut the door. Nobody's there, just me and him or her. And I teach them self-confidence and courage. And I see them walking out of the gym 6 inches off the ground. That's my payback. That's the payback. I get to give that to somebody else. What I did not have myself, but I can do it. And it's the greatest feeling in the world, because somewhere in that hour I'm with them, the little guy in me is healing too. Hmm. He goes, wow, look at this. This is great. Hmm. And that's a gift that I've always had and I'll always have. And I love that a part of me that has the ability to reach inside and say, listen, it's going to be okay. We're going to make it.
Hmm. We're speaking with former heavyweight boxing champion contender Jerry Cooney, talking about his book, Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery. So you were somebody who apparently had a real knack for boxing, and you achieved some great success early on. Would you call yourself in those young years, your adolescence, a great natural athlete? And did you find yourself drawn to other sports, or were you pretty much solely a boxer?
You know, I wrestled. I liked wrestling. I think I was that one-on-one kind of guy because I couldn't really depend on anybody in life. And unfortunately, when you grow up in a dysfunctional family, you pick other dysfunctional people. And you just, you know, you continue until you get away. When I turned pro, I broke away from that and I traveled. I was in California. I was in Alaska. I was in Vegas. And I met different people who I could learn from. And, you know, when you're in the ring with there's four guys out there waiting. I'm in the ring with one guy and there's three other guys. You really have to think about what's going on. And you have to stay ahead of them. And the thing is, like, when I'm boxing one guy, the other three or four guys are watching me trying to find my mistakes. So I have to keep, you know, developing and cleaning it up and paying attention to what's happening. And that's how you become world class. So, anyway, yeah, I mean, listen, we all struggle somewhere, somehow in life. And I only pray that you take the time to ask the question. I mean, that was the first time I went to a meeting somewhere and I heard somebody say, can you help me? And I thought, wow, you can say that? And I've been asking that question ever since.
Wow, right. We should mention that your brother Tommy was also a boxer. Can you talk for a moment?
My life.
Yeah, tell us more about the relationship the two of you had and the way in which boxing was a really important part of both of your lives.
You know, it was so good. My brother left the home when he was 15 because he couldn't take it anymore, right? The rest of my brothers left the house at 17 to be on our own. We couldn't take it anymore. And so I love my brother Tom. I could never get a chance to see him. He went to boxing. And so at this local junior high school, there was a boxing, Huntington Recreation. So I wanted to go and see him. And I always had a heavy bag in the basement. So I went to the gym and I thought, wow, this is great. I felt good on the heavy bag, not realizing somebody was going to come at me. And this little Italian guy knocked me around the ring. And I got to spend a lot of time with my brother. I went home. At 15 and a half, I thought, I forget, I'm not going to do this. But I went down in the basement and hit the bag again, understanding someone was going to pressure me. I went back to the gym. I asked if I could box that kid again, and with my brother there. And he could never do that to me anymore. 6 months later, at 16, I won the middleweight championship in the New York State Golden Gloves Championships. And it made people look at me, made people aware of who I was and what a feat that was. And unfortunately, when you grow up in that kind of a dysfunctional family, you never think you're good enough. And that I had five knockouts in seven fights. I should have done better. That's what we grow up in, that family system, and we have to learn our way out of it. And I've spent a lot of years, not just on myself, but on my other siblings, to try and help them get help. And some of them took it, some of them didn't. And, you know, the ones that didn't are affected by it today. It's got to be painful.
Mm, for sure. You, as a professional boxer, were most renowned as a very hard puncher, one of the hardest punchers in the business, especially for your big left hook. Is that the way it was right from the start? I mean, is that, I guess another way to ask the question is, you know, if we watched Jerry Cooney, the young amateur, you know, competing in Golden Gloves, how much does that boxing, your style of boxing then, resemble professional Jerry Cooney, whom we saw boxing on television? I mean, did you evolve a lot as a boxer over those years? Or by and large, did you approach boxing pretty much the same way throughout your amateur and professional careers?
You know, I'll tell you what. So when I went to the gym, everybody threw their left hand as a jab. So I was right-handed. I'm supposed to fight southpaw. But because I fought right-handed, I had all my power in my left hand. So every time I jabbed you, it was like hitting you with the right hand. Now, unfortunately for me, not unfortunately, because I've done a very good job, is I could have used a jab and boxed more, but I wanted to get to the ribs. I always wanted to get inside to the ribs, because you take that distance away and you make them back up. And when they back up, you can land solid shots. And that was a blessing to me, that I am a converted southpaw. So instead of fighting with my right hand leading, I use my left hand, and that saved my life, because I could do everything with my left hand, uppercuts, hooks, jabs. And that was I never really realized, or crazy to say, I never thought I was a great puncher. But I was knocking everybody out. I almost thought sometimes they were doing it on purpose to build my confidence. But I was knocking guys out all the time, breaking ribs. I broke an orbit bone in a guy's in his eye. So anyway, yeah, I'm and unfortunately, when my fight game was over, when my career was over, I finally realized I was a great puncher. People still talk about it. So yeah,
they absolutely anyways, do. Yeah. So one of the things you've talked about already in this interview, and this certainly comes up in the book, is all of the hurt and anger that you had in terms of the abuse with which you were living with your family, especially your dad, that yes. That in some ways then boxing was this outlet for you to let out that anger. So describe what your relationship would be with, for instance, the other guys you were boxing in the ring, and both inside and out of the ring. I mean, if we met young Jerry Cooney, would we think, boy, he's an angry man, angry young man, or were you otherwise, you know, the gentle soul that you are now? I mean, is that who you were? But then something would happen when the gloves went on and the fight was on. Would this anger kind of spill out of you? I mean, where was that anger in you, and in what ways did we see it?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, I went to boxing for my anger, and then you learn to harness it. You learn to calm it down, and you make mistakes, and you go out, and you're angry, and you make mistakes. So you learn to clean it up and not express it, because when you express your anger, you leave yourself vulnerable. And that's very bad in boxing. And listen, when I was 16, when the bell rang, I was like a gladiator, and the other guy was a gladiator, and I had to get in first. And fortunately, I was a good puncher. So I'd come out, and I'd get in there and bang him around. I'd take a couple of shots. But my thing was harness the anger, control it, find the opening. And I think when you become a professional athlete, even in the amateurs, you're so aware of what's going on in there that every time I jab, I watch what you're doing. When I throw a right hand, I watch what you're doing, and I can see where you're weak, where you're vulnerable, and then I pray on that. And that's what a world-class athlete gets to do, is you can make adjustments during the round. I can watch a film of somebody and see what he does, but when you get in there, it's different. And so you make adjustments during the round. You find the opening, you set the guy up again to where he was last time, and you land the shot, and you watch the expression on his face change, like, oh boy, that hurt. And that made you feel good.
Right, absolutely. Interesting. One thing we haven't mentioned yet in terms of your amateur career, and again, you were a two-time Golden Gloves champion, is that you didn't just box here, but if I remember correctly, you also boxed internationally. I mean, you won Golden Gloves matches in other countries.
I was on the United States team. I had five fights, four over in Europe. I had all knockouts. You know, I hit a guy one time, Joe Griffin, his name was, in Scotland. I have some Scottish in me. I hit him with the best left hook I ever threw. And you know what? He just looked at me. And I thought, oh, no, what am I going to do now? Bell rings. I come back the second round. I work on the body and knock him out in the second round with body shots. So that's what you do. You know, obviously, you know, you hit the guy with the best punch I ever threw. He just looked at me. I thought, oh, my God, how am I going to deal with this? But you find a way. And then, I fought this big Russian guy who was like 300 pounds. He was 6x6, right? And I had to fight him. So I got in there, and, you know, I always was going to check him. I hit him with a hook and knocked him out cold. And I had all my friends and family, friendships from all the clubs we used to be at. They were there screaming, Loonies for Cooney. And, you know, so it was great moments for me. I grew in those moments. I grew in all those experiences with people. I got to be with people like Bob Hope, Frank Sinatra, you name it, Chevy Chase. I was with everybody. You know, I think about my life and Jake LaMotta, Willie Pep, all those guys, and I grew from all of those guys. My experiences, the questions I asked, that was just so, it was like history class for me. And I still carry that with me today. I think of those guys so fondly.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jerry Cooney, talking about the book Gentleman Jerry, a contender in the ring, a champion in recovery. So you entered the world of professional boxing in the mid-1970s. What did that feel like to go from the amateur ranks to the professional ranks? What kind of a change did that involve, except for the most obvious, which is you started to get a paycheck in a way that you hadn't before. But, I mean, otherwise, how different did those worlds seem to you, the amateur ranks versus the professional ranks?
You know, I want to tell you that I was in a gym where my trainer's kid was turning pro, and they were so excited. He's going to be a professional fighter and all that. So I kind of lived that experience with him, right? It was really nice. But when I turned pro, I didn't have family. I didn't have a father in my corner. I didn't have my mother in my corner. You know, I was alone. So I was fearful. At the same time, hungry. I was fearful and hungry. And it wasn't like a choice. It wasn't like I had options. It was my only option. And I had to make the best of it at 18, 19 years old. You know, I missed out on so much. You know, like I didn't have a choice. There was one way to go for me. I had to become a fighter. I had to be successful. Because all I thought about at 18 was, how am I going to get a wife and kids and a home? You know, that's what you think about when you don't have somebody expressing themselves and explaining that to you. You feel scared. And so every time I got in the ring, I couldn't wait for the bell to ring because I had to get going. I gotta do it. And I was very lucky, and I stayed lucky. I was talented. I'm this is the first time I think I've ever said that. I was also very talented at creating. You know, it's like a split second when you the difference between a club fighter and a world class fighter is split second timing. that I can create, I can land the shot when I find the opening. Like, it's just amazing. And you get that world-class timing, and you can create what you want. It's nothing like it in the world.
Hmm.
I saw a wrestler, an Olympic wrestler, Anthony Ashworth, from Rutgers, and I was watching him wrestle this top world guy, and he had to grab his little ankle. He had like 1/100th of a second, and he waited, and he waited, and he waited, and he grabbed it. And that split-second timing is everything to great athletes. That's what makes the world go round in our world.
Hmm. Let's talk about the kind of people that populated the professional boxing world, because sometimes that's where we hear of maybe some of the darkest or more disturbing aspects of the sport will be trainers and managers and so on, and the way that they treat their boxers and the way they kind of go about their business. What was your experience as a professional boxer in terms of those kind of people with whom you worked? Were you, by and large, lucky or unlucky in that respect?
Well, I was lucky in the respect that I went around. I had a good friend of mine. I was 15 years old, and he was a bartender. He was a good, really good friend. And he'd come around with me, and we'd, you know, meet with this group and that group and this group, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just playing, trying to play, right, make believe. And I ran into these two guys who had signed Howard Davis. Now, Howard Davis was the Olympic gold medal winner in the 1976 Olympics, and I figured they were going to pay me every week. I didn't have to, if I didn't win, I wouldn't have to pay them back. And I got to fight on all the cards that Howard Davis fought on. So I got this experience. I got this, they were seeing me on television. I was being viewed. And so that's the reason why I did it. I regret it today. I wished I had signed with a Top Rank or a Gil Clancy, one of those guys who could have really developed me and made me move in the right direction. And my team always tried to make me feel like they were doing me a favor. So there's no favors. And then, you know, obviously the money was good. They got the money. But see, what happened to me is in 1981, I knocked out Ken Norton in 54 seconds of the first round. Now, I could have gone a lot of different ways. I could have went for Mike Weaver. There was a lot of other guys out there that I could have fought first to get the experience I needed so that when I got into the ring with Holmes, I could be more ready, more tools, more preparation. But they settled on the big payday, which was Larry Holmes. In some ways, you understand it, but that wasn't really looking out for Jerry Cooney. Like, I needed more experience. I needed some more looks, more, you know, bells to ring. And so I didn't get that. So I waited from Norton. I had to wait 13 months because I also, part of the problem was I tore a rotator cuff, and I had to take some time off to rehabilitate that. And I knocked out Norton in 54 seconds. I don't fight for 13 months, and they put me in there with the heavyweight champ of the world, Larry Holmes.
Right.
Now, he and I are great, great friends today. I love that guy. He loves me. But back in that day, he was angry at me. I was angry at him. There was all this racism going on. Had nothing to do with Larry Holmes. Had nothing to do with Jerry Cooney. It had to do with the people promoting the fight to make money, and that's a sin.
Right. And so, just to underscore this for people, although maybe they can put this together, this hugely anticipated fight between the two of you was to such a large extent billed as almost a battle of the races. I mean, this great black boxer, the champion, versus this great white boxer. And I know from what you say in the book that this was something that was really upsetting to you. I mean, it placed this fight in a context that you just weren't comfortable with.
So let me just explain this to you. So I had like five or six guys I grew up with in high school that we hung around, and we were living in Palm Springs. We were living in Vegas. I remember eating lobster tail and turtle soup. You know, this guy had meat and potatoes where I grew up, you know what I mean? Meat and potatoes every night. And so we were living the dream. There was no racism. I was like in my glory. Who was ever going to get an opportunity? And not only me, but my friends would never get an opportunity like that either. So we kind of lived together in this great experience with, I told you, Frank Sinatra, Bob Hope, Dean Martin, all those people. And we got to experience all those things. I remember going to a party for the Holmes Cooney fight. It was everybody I ever wanted to meet my whole life. Jack Nicholas, Nicholson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, just everybody. So, yeah, we didn't have anything to do with that. And Holmes didn't either. He's a good man. I'm very good friends with him today. And I'd like to fight him now because I know I could kick his ass now. You know what I'm saying?
Larry Holmes had this to say about you. Jerry is a hell of a man. If he would have waited 1 year later, he would have been heavyweight champ of the world. To me, he is a great man, and I've always liked him, and we will always be friends. So you can't ask for much more than that from a tribute.
Listen, let me tell you something. And he doesn't believe that I could beat him like I believe I could beat him. What I learned from him that night in the ring was unbelievable. And what I learned, the experience I got from that, if I could have taken, I don't know why we didn't have a second fight. We deserved a second fight. And then, but anyway, he was just great. He was just great. And he's a nice man. He's a good man. He's a family man. He's got a beautiful wife, great family. And he's a very proud heavyweight champion. He held the championship for 7.5 years. And so I was grateful just to be in there with him. And today, I feel great. I'm on the radio. I'm on Sirius XM every Monday, every Friday from 3 to 5 on Channel 156 with Randy Gordon. And we have At the Fights, it's called. We talk all about everything boxing. And so life is good. You know, I mean, would I have liked to win that championship? Yeah. Would I have liked to not get distracted after the Holmes fight and fall down and make those mistakes? Yeah. But unfortunately, maybe it also saved my life. Life was so fast, going around so fast, and maybe I would have got lost. So anyway, it turned out the way God wanted it to turn out, and I'm good with that.
Hmm. Can I just ask you about your recovery from some of these demons that chased you? To what do you attribute the recovery that you were ultimately able to make?
Oh, wow. You know, mental, physical, spiritual. So I read a lot about it, about the illness. It's an illness. It's a legitimate illness. It's not just bad people. Physical is I train. I work out with people. I'm educated. I exercise. I walk with my wife. And spiritual, God is good. God saved my life. And I was upset. You know, there's a story about God was walking on the beach with this guy, and during the guy's most troublesome times, there was only one set of footprints, and he said, God, you left me during my most difficult times. And God said, no, my son, that's when I carried you. And I believe that. And had I beat Holmes that night, who knows if I'd be on with you on the radio this morning. Life was so fast, so many things were happening. And so I think it turned out the way it was supposed to be. And I'm hoping to be able to give this information that I learned to some other young man to make him reach the high note.
So people can seek out even more of this story in the book Gentleman Jerry, A Contender in the Ring, A Champion in Recovery, published by Roman and Littlefield, written by John Grady in cooperation with my morning show guest, Gentleman Jerry Cooney. Mr. Cooney, it's been great to talk with you. I am so glad to see you and hear you being so happy and fulfilled at this point in your life. And I appreciate you sharing your story with the world and with our morning show listeners today. Very best wishes to you.
I love you. I love you. Thank you to all your listeners. And listen, whenever there's a big fight coming up, call me. I'll break it down for you. I'll tell you who's going to win.
Excellent. Thank you again for your time today.
Thank you. Bye now.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going to stay in the world of sports, but shift our attention from boxing to basketball. Out of the Archives, an interview from 2010 with best-selling author Gary M. Pomerantz, talking about his remarkable book, Wilt 1962, The Night of 100 Points and the Dawn of a New Era. The book tells the story of the night in 1962 in Hershey, Pennsylvania, when the legendary Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points in a single game, a remarkable record that still stands to this very day. One of the things which, of course, is interesting about this great, great night for Wilt Chamberlain is the fact that there is absolutely no film of this game, or certainly the game in its entirety was not telecast, and maybe you can explain that if any of it at all was telecast. But basically, we just have grainy still photos and the accounts of people who were on hand to witness it. That makes it, in this modern age, sort of an odd, important moment in sports history.
Yeah, well, certainly Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game is the Everest of sports records. It's never been approached. No other player in the NBA has ever scored 90 or 80 or even 75 points in a game. The next highest total is 73 points by David Thompson of Denver in a 1978 game. And, of course, as we watch the NBA playoff games now, very few teams are scoring 100 points in a game. And, you know, while it's one of sports' most legendary moments, what I discovered during my 3 years of research was that hardly anyone knew anything about it. This game, for all of its legend, has been almost like a sunken galleon resting on the ocean floor, just waiting to be recovered. And part of the mythology of the game is, as you say, that it was not televised. None of the New York press even bothered to show up because the season was nearly over and the Knicks were a last-place team. The Philadelphia Inquirer, a fine newspaper, didn't even send its correspondent to the game only 90 miles from the newsroom. And so all that exists from the coverage of that game is, you know, the scant media accounts, but also a bootleg copy of the fourth quarter play-by-play call of WCAU radio in Philadelphia. And that only really sort of come into existence in pieces over the years, but the entire fourth quarter was taped by a young fan in Amherst, Massachusetts. He was a big basketball fan. In fact, he broadcast the games of his school on the school radio station. And when he realized the import of what was happening here, he taped it. And thank goodness he did, because that tape has become like the Zapruder film of this game. You know, as Abraham Zapruder caught the Kennedy assassination in Dallas 18 months later, here was a tape really unearthed in about 1991 that really has answered a lot of questions about how it happened, how it unfolded in that fourth quarter against the Knicks and Hershey.
Amazing. You, of course, talk in this book about more than this incredible game. You also talk about this incredible athlete named Wilt Chamberlain and give this game, of course, some valuable context. One of the things you do at length is talk about what made Wilt Chamberlain such an extraordinary figure in basketball. And you say that right off the bat, he was perfection when it came to both body and ego.
Yes, I mean, you know, you can find now the shorthand summary of Wilt's life in two numbers, 20,000 and 100. You know, the 20,000, of course, comes from his boast late in life that he had slept with 20,000 women, and the 100 comes from the 100-point night in Hershey. And, you know, Wilt died 5 years ago of a heart attack at the age of 63 at his home in Bel Air in Southern California. And he was afflicted with a Goliath syndrome. He had this nearly obsessive need to prove his greatness in all things, big and small. And so the same need or impulse to score 100 points in a game in 1962 at the age of 25, to bend not only the Knicks, but really an entire sport to his will, transformed decades later into the need to create a myth-maker's boast of sexual conquest, 20,000 women. And you know, needless to say, one number can be proven, the other number cannot.
Hmm. You call Wilt Chamberlain a one-man revolution, and a little later in the book you quote basketball great Oscar Robertson saying that Wilt Chamberlain single-handedly saved the league. Let's talk about that second quote. In what way is that true?
Well, it's really true in two ways. Wilt Chamberlain entered the NBA in 1959, and when he entered the league, it was still largely a white man's enclave. it was still pretty much a feet-on-the-floor horizontal game. And Wilt changed the style. He led the movement that changed the style of play, more athletic eloquence, more speed, and certainly more self-expression. He took this game vertical. He took it above the rim and made it uniquely his. Think about 1959. The civil rights movement is taking flight in America. And there was unquestionably in the NBA during the 1950s and still into the early 60s a quota that limited the number of African-American players to initially one or two players per team and then three and four. And, you know, this was not written down and codified. It was understood. It was systemic in all of American culture. And I think what Wilt Chamberlain did in 1962 by averaging 50 points per game that season against the league's best white players and by scoring 100 points in that game in Hershey was to symbolically blow that quota to smithereens.
Hmm. Let's talk about the game. And you, I mean, not the capital G game, I mean the game of on this night in March in 1962. You have mentioned the fact that at the time there was scant attention given to the game going in, and some attention, of course, coming out of it, but probably nowhere close to proportion in terms of what really was accomplished that night. Explain what, if anything, remains sort of shrouded in mystery about that night, about exactly how that game was played. Are there important things that we do not know?
Well, yes. I mean, we don't know the play-by-play of the first three quarters. And, of course, the investigator in me was maddened by that. You know, I wanted to know everything that was knowable. What we have are you know, Wilt's statistics, his personal statistics from each quarter of that game. And of course, we have the full play-by-play from the fourth quarter. But again, the mythology of the game is such that it almost adds to it. You know, and you know, think about 1962. The nation is at a very different time. Kennedy and Khrushchev are locked in their Cold War showdown. And only 10 days before this game in Hershey, John Glenn had blasted into orbit, and he returned home with a great line. John Glenn said, "What can you say about a day in which you see four beautiful sunsets?" I mean, it was a time so distant that when Wilt Chamberlain scored his 100-point basket with 46 seconds to play, you have all of these kids, you know, running out onto the court. It was like a dam bursting, and the kids surging onto the court to congratulate Wilt. And, you know, the first boy to get to him, 14-year-old, reached out, shook his hand, and Wilt bounced the ball, and then the kid stole it. You know, and what's the joy to me about the story is not the theft, but just the idea that it was such a distant time that this boy could reach out and touch his fan. And
it's quaint.
Touch his hero. Yes, it is quaint. And you know, I mean, today we'd have security guards, we'd have policemen maybe on horseback, and we can't get near our heroes. So there was something really engaging and almost romantic about it. This game, to me, is trying to capture it is a little bit like trying to capture Franklin Roosevelt. You know, Americans didn't see him every day on TV, you know, but they heard his voice in those fireside chats. And, you know, their imagination was at play. This game has much that same quality.
Hmm. By the way, you mentioned the fact that Wilt Chamberlain was involved in an earlier game in which he scored 90 points, if I remember correctly.
Well, yes, that was not in the NBA. That
right.
was in high school in Philadelphia at Overbrook High School. And, I mean, remember, that was in only playing an eight-minute quarter. So in 32 minutes, you know, he's scoring 90 points.
And he sat out a little bit of the game.
Yes, he did.
And the final score, we should mention, is 123-21. So,
yes, it was not the kindest act ever committed by a player, a team, and a coach, I suppose. But, you know, his coach felt that, you know, he had talked to the athletic director at Overbrook High School and said, you know, what do I do? I've got Wilt Chamberlain, and you know, he can break all these records. What should we do? I don't want to embarrass teams. And the response from the athletic director at the school was, well, I coach the track team, and I don't tell my runners to slow down at the end. You know, cut them loose, and let's see what happens.
Hmm. As for this great game in 1962, you mentioned the fact that there is this bootleg recording of at least some of the fourth quarter radio broadcast. How helpful is that?
Well, it's very helpful. And, you know, by the way, your listeners might be able to hear it. They can hear it online at www.wilt1962.com. And it's really a fun tape. I mean, you can really, it puts you there, and you can feel the crowd, the smallness of it, and then you can feel the building excitement as Wilt gets closer to 100 points.
Hmm.
But you know, it was a very helpful piece of evidence for me as a, you know, in this game. But also, you know, I traveled the country and interviewed 15 of the surviving players from the two teams, the Philadelphia Warriors and the New York Knicks, from that night. And these men are now in their middle 60s to middle 70s. And some of their memories and their impressions from that night were invaluable. For instance, the young center who played against Wilt Chamberlain that night, Daryl Imhoff, now is at the U.S. Basketball Academy in Eugene, Oregon. When I went to see him, there was an open basketball court there. And I said, Daryl, come over here and show me how you played against Wilt that night. Well, look, I mean, I'm 5'10 and a half. I'm not a great stand-in for the Big Dipper. But Imhoff showed me what he did and how he said, you know, Wilt used to lean back into him, and Imhoff was standing behind Chamberlain down low. And he said, you know, it forced me to recoil. He was so strong and so big, I felt like a tree was about to fall on me.
Mm.
And Imhoff, of course, is 6'10". I said, well, what did you do? And he showed me how he positioned his feet, keeping Wilt Chamberlain from being able to turn in towards the basket for a dipper dunk. And he said, you know, when Wilt leaned back, what I would do is I would take the point of my right elbow and I would put it here, and he put it right between my shoulder blades. And I'm here to tell you, Greg, all this time later, Daryl Imhoff can still inflict pain with that elbow because it hurt. It hurt. And one of the many misconceptions about the game is that the Knicks didn't care. Well, they did care, and they cared mightily. I mean, this was the ultimate indignity, to give up 100 points to a player. And so they were surrounding him with three and four players at the end of the game. The regular flow of the game broke down. Wilt's teammate, the rookie Tom Mascheri, told me it's the only time in his lengthy NBA career that he remembers being in a game where he would pass the ball and then stand there and watch.
Hmm. You mentioned that Wilt Chamberlain did not boast of this 100-point game. In fact, you said not ever, which is extraordinary when you know, given what you tell us about Wilt Chamberlain and his desire to achieve this kind of greatness. Can you explain that to us, how he would not boast about such an amazing feat?
It sounds hard to believe because Wilt Chamberlain boasted about just about everything. And yet there was something about this game, and I think it was that he took 63 shots from the field, 36 of 63 shots from the field, and miraculously he made 28 of 32 free throws that night, shooting them underhanded. And, you know, Wilt, in the locker room after that game, told his teammate Al Attles that he just couldn't believe he took 63 shots. And Al Attles said, what's the matter, big fella? You made more than half of them, 36. I think that's okay. And Wilt was afraid that this game would feed the notion that he cared only about his statistics, only about scoring and not about winning. And so he liked to talk more about his 1960 performance against the Celtics' Bill Russell, when he pulled down a record still of 55 rebounds. And it wasn't until near the end of his life that Wilt really began to embrace the 100-point game. He came to realize what an achievement it was. And, you know, we're a nation that loves offense. We love scoring. And so when he walked down the street, of course, people noticed and stared because he was just such a remarkable physical specimen. But he also began to realize that people would point at him and fathers would tell their sons, whispering, there's the guy who scored 100 points in a single game.
Hmm. The book is Wilt 1962. The book is written by Gary Pomerantz. The publisher is Crown Publishers. Gary Pomerantz, I love this book. It is just absolutely terrific, and I'm really glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. I thank you so much.
I thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Monday on The Morning Show, we'll be celebrating Assisted Living Week with Nancy Davies and Lisa DiBartolo, who are both community outreach coordinators for Library Terrace Assisted Living. Our weather forecast today is for partly sunny skies and mild temperatures, a high of 68 degrees. You're advised not to swim in Lake Michigan today or through tomorrow afternoon because of dangerous waves and currents. Partly cloudy overnight, low of 45. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 66. And then a warming trend. By the middle of next week, it will be sunny and hot. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.